Welcome, everybody. My name's Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous, and I will be your facilitator for today's presentation, sponsored by the CA Service Sponsorship Workshop called Carry the Message, Not the Wreckage. As a speaker and a facilitator of 12-step recovery, I've spoken to numerous AA, CA groups, including district roundups, area conventions, CA world conventions. I've spoken at other fellowships too, like CODA and Al-Anon and SLA and NA. I've spoken to numerous audiences across Canada, the United States, the UK, Europe, covering topics such as 12 steps, 12 traditions, 12 concepts. I have, prior to my recovery years, coached audiences on how to be better keynote speakers, including overcoming the fears of public speaking, structuring your talk, dynamics for excellent presentations, powerful openings and closings, key messaging, etc. And it is my hope today that this CA Service Sponsorship presentation will prove helpful to those who wish to carry a message, to those who suffer from addiction in and across the rooms of all 12-step recovery. So my take-home message to all of you here today is you're all going to become circuit speakers. Carrying the message, not the wreckage. So what we're going to cover today is every individual, and you know, in their own personal stories, describe in their own language, from their own point of view, the way they establish their relationship with God or a higher power, a divine consciousness, higher consciousness, whatever word you want to put to. This is the whole point of our recovery, is connecting to a power far greater than ourselves deep down within us that lets us easily control our desire to drink, to use, or to act out. Now, we can only clear the ground a bit as members. So it is our testimony that helps away to sweep away any prejudices that people in the rooms, when they hear us speak about this power. Every addict in this room has a story to share. And somewhere in the fellowship, there is an ear that needs to hear your story, to resonate with you and say, hey, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore. And I want what you have. So your recovery story as an ex-problem addict is important. It's vital to the fellowship. And a good effective share will identify with those who struggle with addiction so that, as I said, they will in turn turn to you and say, hey, I'm like you. That's the whole point. You're like me, but you don't do it anymore. And I want what you have. And we can take them on that amazing journey of 12 steps. And then by sharing what happened to us and what we're like today, the newcomer comes to believe that there is hope, that they too can escape their difficulties and win the newcomer's confidence. So carrying the message, not the wreckage, we must be careful not to drift into worry, remorse, morbid reflection, for that would diminish our usefulness to others. I hear a lot of this, you know, you hear a lot of worry, remorse, and morbid reflection, certainly in the news, certainly on social media. And unfortunately, we hear a certain amount of it in the rooms. And it's important that we be cognizant of, you know, what it is we're sharing. So we're sharing a message and not the wreckage. And what we don't want to do.
You talk too much, you worry me to death. You talk too much, you even worry my pet. You just talk too much.
So you've been asked to share at a meeting, a convention, a roundup. Now what? Now, far too often, I have heard over 20 years of working with others and carrying the message, I hear that, you know, we all know about the stereotypical drunkalog, the war stories, the junkie pride tales, and even I've seen people go to the podium and just ramble on incoherently about whatever minutia is going on in one's life. I always know I'm in for one of those long-winded war stories when the speaker starts with, This is more like AA. I try not to make too much fun of AA, but they'll go to the podium and go, "I remember my first drink. I was in my mother's third trimester, and I realized I didn't drink like other fetuses." And I go, "Oh God, here we go, right?" And it's all this bad news share about their drinking, their war story, how much they could drink or use or act out. And I already know how to drink. I already know how to use. I don't need any more experience in that kind of intel. I need to know enough about you that I realize you're one of us, but I don't need any more, intel about how I should be drinking or how I should be using or acting out. And the other thing I see also in the rooms is some speakers never know when to stop. I'll hear them many times in their share, and they'll sound like they're wrapping up. Oh, this is great. They're going to wrap up here. And then they go on to another train of thought. And then when I think they're wrapping up, they go on to another train of thought, constantly digressing into another stream of consciousness going on pretty much ad nauseum. So one of the things we're going to look at is know when to wrap it up. Because you don't want to leave your audience feeling like you talk too much. What we're going to do today, our learning objectives for this presentation, and at the end of this presentation, all of you, because you all have a story, is you'll be able to list 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of speaking in front of an audience. You'll know 5 ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. You'll be able to identify 3 major benefits of speaking at a 12-step meeting or event, 3 key elements for a compelling story, 3 ways to win the confidence of a newcomer, 3 essential components for a well-structured story, 3 ways to dynamically open your share, 4 ways to identify and connect with your audience, 5 important ways to describe what happened in your story, 3 ways to inspire others to work their program, and lastly, 3 approaches to dynamically close your talk. I was saying earlier today, dare to be outrageously yourselves, right? Create your own style. The rooms don't need another Cameron F. So I'm not here for you to emulate my approach to speaking. The room needs you. I make a great Cameron, but I make a lousy any one of you. So my job here is to show you a way in which you can outrageously be yourself and stand out and carry that all-important message to that ear that goes, "Man, I'm like you and you're like me, but you don't do it anymore. And I desperately want what you have." And we get them on that amazing journey. We do have a seventh tradition. It does cost a certain amount of money to put on these presentation. And so if you find the workshop useful, you like what we're doing here, and you think it has value, please consider making a seventh donation, a donation of 20 or 10 or 5. It just goes a long way into offsetting our Zoom costs, our website costs, and we really appreciate the generosity. Fear of public speaking. This affects 1 in 4 people, the general public. A lot of people get very nervous when they're asked to share, very nervous when they have to go to the podium. So the question is, what are we really afraid of, right? Why do we have a fear of going to the podium? So I'd like to just open it up to have a few of you share. Just raise your virtual hand and let's talk about some of the reasons why we might have a certain intrepidation about going to the podium. What are some of the fears that we have? Come on, raise your hands, folks. Anyone? Yes, go ahead, Janice. Oh, let me give you the ability. Hang on a second here. I give people the ability to unmute themselves. There we go. Go ahead, Janice. What are some of the things we're afraid of when we're
So
speaking?
for me, when I get nervous, I feel like I lose my train of thought. And so then I'm just kind of, I don't know.
Yeah.
Even, yeah,
That's a heck of a thing. You get up the podium, you're about to talk, you knew what you were going to say, and all of a sudden your mind goes blank. That's a pretty horrific, horrifying situation. I've been there. I'm just like, what am I supposed to say? Yeah, that's a common fear. What if I forget what I have to share or I can't remember or whatever? Thanks, Janice. Kelly.
Hi, Cameron. Thank you. For me, I think everything, no matter my behavior or what thoughts come in, it's the underlying thing is how I'm perceived by others, how others look at me, how I'm received by them. So that would be my main fear.
And you know, that's another common thing. Am I going to be elegant enough? Am I going to be powerful? What if I'm boring? What if I'm harshly judged by the audience, right? That's, you know, what if I don't look good? You know, these types of fears come up a lot. So thank you. Chris.
Yeah, hi Cameron, thanks for your service. You know, I always was terrified and never really stopped to think why. And I think we've probably touched on it a bit already, but you know, I just, you know, I go in there wanting to do a great job. You know, I think about it in days in advance, and you know, want to be useful and helpful, and but beyond that, just to do a great job, and that's sort of a high hurdle most of the time. And you combine that with nervousness and losing your train of thought, you know, just the opposite of making a fool of yourself is the problem.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we all want to do a good job. And I think the audience wants you to do a good job, right? So yeah, that's common. We don't want to look stupid, we don't want to look awkward, we don't want to be boring, etc. Thank you. Vicky.
Hi everyone, I'm Vicky and I'm a recovered member of CA. Everything that everybody said already, I have a fear like that I'm just gonna sound stupid and I'm not the newcomer isn't gonna hear like the solution. I have a lot of head trauma, so trying to remember what I'm gonna say can be hard. And I took this workshop once before and it helped me a lot because I started like making little bullet points when I was going to speak because I've had so many concussions that I lose my train of thought talking to my mom. So getting up in front of people, being nervous and all that. But I think sounding stupid, not sharing the message and then forgetting what I'm going to say are probably the three major things too.
Thank you, Vicky. Shauna.
Hi, I'm Shauna. I'm an addict. Also all those fears. My biggest fear that hasn't been mentioned is what happens after I speak, that taking my own inventory and realizing, oh, I didn't say this, or I have sometimes trouble to dot my I's, like I'll say a story and then I'll forget to draw the conclusion or make the point because I'm nervous. And also saying that something that I would be ashamed of, not about my story, but by just saying, you know, the spontaneous words coming that I say a wrong thing. Thanks.
How did Frank Sinatra say it? Regrets. I've had a few regrets over some of the things I've said from the podium. And yeah, we can make mistakes for sure. And I'm my worst critic. I really get that. I can be so critical after I share. And now there's one thing to review what you shared and to look at what worked and what didn't work and make adjustments. But yeah, you know, being the nature of addict, being the nature of most people and addicts especially, we tend to be a little overly critical. So thank you, Shauna. Sarah.
Hi, everybody. Sarah Alcoholic Cameron. I just love you. But mine is a little bit different. I came to the United States as an immigrant, and English was not my first language. So when I was in grade school, I was asked to go on stage and take part in a play, and I really didn't know English that well. And when I looked out to the audience, I got stage fright. And ever since then, I can tell you, just as my heart was beating then, it still beats that fast today. So it's, I guess it's vulnerability and lack of confidence, but I do speak English now, so thank you for having me.
Thank you, Sarah. And you know, and yeah, to be really self-conscious about that, I noticed Taffy mentioned having a speech difficulty. Great movie to watch, by the way, is The King's Speech, which is about the king who has stuttered, and he hired a speech therapist to help work with the enunciation and pronunciation of words. So yeah, I get that, Taffy. And there are people that can be helpful in that respect, learning to speak in a way despite whatever impediment or you know, problem you might have, to find ways to overcome that. So thanks for bringing that up. Lee, go ahead.
Thank you, Cameron. And thank you for having this. I got two issues. I'm like recovering some trauma, so apparently I don't have a filter, if you're familiar with that term, and I also struggle with the ADHD when the bird comes, and I'll just go off in several different directions at one time, and sometimes I can speak and I'm right on target, and other times it's train wreck. I never know, so I get very anxious. That's what I got.
Thanks. Yeah, I've got no filter. Sometimes I can say things that are tactless, or I should have been, you know, kept my mouth shut a little bit longer and kind of considered what I was about to say. I think that comes with experience. I do it far less than I used to back in the early days of speaking. So, you know, the great thing about going to the podium in a 12-step program is one's focus. You know, whenever I focused on me, it always came out wrong, you know, but when I focused on carrying the message to the newcomer, a lot of those fears tended to dissipate. But you know, fear is a big problem. Like I said, it affects one in four people of the general public. You know, as we said, being harshly judged, not being eloquent, forgetting body, you know, sometimes our body reacts in certain ways. I'll never forget, when I went to university in my 50s, I did humanities, and you know, being the nature of humanities, you often had to form groups and do a presentation on whatever that particular lecture was about. And of course, I'm amongst 21, 22, 23-year-old people who were very nervous about speaking in front of a class of 80, 90 people. So it often was deferred to me because I had no problem going to the front of the room and talking. And I'll never forget, I watched one young woman, she was about 22, 23, and she went up to the front of the room to speak. And it was like she had no control of her body. It just froze. And the look of terror on her face was so painful. I just wanted to go up to her and put my arms around her and go, "It's okay, honey. It's not that important." But it was so intense seeing this person freeze in terror at the front of the room and having to present. But the good news is there's ways through that, you know, and breaking through those fears of being a failure or looking incompetent or making mistakes or forgetting what we're talking about or not being worthy enough to be at the front of the room. Okay, so back to our slideshow here. Fear of public speaking affects one in four people, the general public. Now, you may be surprised to know, do you know what most people are afraid of? Well, I'm gonna let you know. Spiders and snakes. My mother used to be terrified of spiders. How many people have a fear of spiders and snakes? Raise your virtual hand if you got a fear of spiders and snakes. Like I said, my mother would go absolutely crazy at the sight of a spider. Now, according to a 2002 poll, why is Cameron talking about spiders and snakes? One in three North Americans have a fear of snakes, and one in four North Americans have a fear of spiders. And my son Victor, he breeds tarantulas and snakes. Go figure, eh? So, how do we overcome our fear of public speaking? We give a presentation on spiders and snakes. I throw the strategy in of overcoming one's fear of spiders and snakes as a bonus. All right, seriously though. Okay, 10 strategies for overcoming the fear of public speaking. Any one of these strategies can help break it, alleviate it, but I'm going to give you 10. So the first thing is to structure your presentation. Give some mindful thought as to what you want to say, what you want to cover, and we'll look at structure in a few minutes. The thing I suggest you avoid is stream of consciousness sharing. Some people get kind of annoyed with this presentation. Oh, you're one of those guys that teach kind of like Toastmasters. You have a formula for speaking, and they all sound the same. That's not what I'm suggesting. And when it comes to some people say, well, you shouldn't prepare. You should let God work through you in whatever manner God wants to speak through you when you go to the podium. And I kind of get that attitude. But so many times I've seen speakers go to the podium with no idea what they're going to say sometimes, and they just start talking with whatever stream of consciousness is on their mind in that given moment. Now, this can be a real impediment when it comes to delivering an effective message. The problem with stream of consciousness is sometimes it's a great share. I remember one person just went up, did his thing, and it was like mind-blowing. But after the presentation, he couldn't remember what it was he did or said. He couldn't duplicate it. And other times, that stream of consciousness, they go to the front and it's just, ad nauseum minutia, and it makes no sense, or it's disjointed or whatever. And again, the same problem is afterwards, they have no idea what they said, and they don't know how to correct it for the future to improve on one's presentation, and learn from whatever mistakes were made. So by writing down your presentation, a couple things happen. One, it embeds it further into your thought and memory processes, and this is further reinforced through, rehearsing, practicing. One person accused me, "Oh, you're that guy that gets people to stand in front of the mirror and speak." No, not quite. And it was rather, he was being really pejorative about it. I said, "Well, I've heard your share, and quite frankly, it's boring. You want to give feedback? I can give you feedback." But rehearsing and practicing your key messages, and there's a lot of opportunities to do that. You get a lot of opportunities to practice your key messaging. You can do it in discussion-oriented meetings. So when it goes around the circle of the room and it's your turn to share, depending on the subject matter or whatever the context of that meeting is, gives you a chance to practice a key message, see how it goes over with your audience. And you get to try out, like I've tried out many different things within the rooms that allow people to share about this and that for as it goes around the circle. One of the things I will offer up for those of you that got speaking engagements coming up, or you just want to really fine-tune your talk, you're welcome to reach out to me after the presentation, and we can set up a Zoom link, and you can present to me your share. I will record it, and then I'll email, and I'll give you feedback at the end of it, things we could think about, possible suggestions or adjustments. And then I'll send you your recording so you can watch yourself, make adjustments, and then call me back in the future and re-present, and I'll record that for you too to help you be the best possible speaker you can be in carrying the message. So I put that out, and my contact details will go in the chat field later on in the presentation. Okay. The third thing, so rehearse your presentation, practice, practice, practice. Now, one other thing you should do before you speak, and I do this often when I go to a meeting, I'll take time to pray and meditate. I just get centered, right? And just bring my body. Sometimes I got to go to the washroom. I got to bring my body to center, and I get emotionally, physically, mentally centered before going on. And again, we have a great prayer in our big book. Instead, we let God demonstrate through us what God can do. We ask God to remove our fear, direct our attention to what God would have us be, and at once we commence to outgrow fear. And I find that very useful. Oh, another thing in terms of your presentation. You want to avoid jargon. Here in Toronto, we have a group of people that are big book advocates. They're called Muckers. And there's a passage in the big book where they talk about the three different types of drinker: the moderate drinker that can take it or leave it alone, the heavy drinker that, given sufficient reason, can stop or curtail their use. And then what about the real alcoholic, where they lose all control? And they refer to these three different types of drinkers as types 1, 2, and 3. Often I've heard muckers be sharing, they'll be talking, well, I'm not a type 1, I'm not a type 2, I'm not a type 3, without any reference to what that means. And the trouble with jargon is that if your audience isn't in on the jargon, the message isn't going to reach them. So if you do use jargon, define your term when you're speaking so that you bring the audience in on that particular phrase or that particular type of jargon. The other thing you want to do, you want to avoid vulgar language. Now, sometimes vulgar language has its place. You know, one of the things I find in Cocaine Anonymous is I can be a lot grittier with my audience. Knowing your audience is important. You want to know your audience. You know, when I speak in AA, I don't swear because they won't hear it. They just won't hear it. You know, they'll shut down. They'll turn off. They'll walk out. In CA, I can be a lot grittier. When I speak in NA, because NA comes from a different narrative, not the big book, I got to be very mindful about what references I use when I share. Like, they prefer the word clean as opposed to sober. So you got to know your audience and address it accordingly. So vulgar language may or may have a place. I don't recommend a lot of vulgar language. I used to be really vulgar in my presentation. I remember one of the first times I shared, a woman came up to me in AA and she goes, Cameron, you have a good message, but you have a filthy mouth. And it really hit me that all this woman was going to remember about my message was that I had a filthy mouth. And I missed the purpose for being there as a speaker, to carry the message to those that suffer. You know, I used to, and this is another reason why it's important to structure your presentation, pay attention to what you're saying, and pay attention to how the audience reacts. I used to use a story, an analogy, where this is an AA thing where I'm talking about drinking, and I'm a bourbon drinker. And I says, they should market bourbon like cigarettes, you know, packages of cigarettes. They have diseased lungs and people that look horrifically old as a result of smoking, you know, images that would scare people. I said, they should market bourbon that way. They should have a picture of a woman on the bottle with a black eye. And you know what? Very few people laughed because it cut too close to home in the audience. Too many people in the audience were subjected to domestic abuse. And I got a real hit of that, you know, when I was using that analogy, and I realized, you know, that's got to go. That can't be, that one's no good. And that's partly, I was able to do that because I'm paying attention to what it is I'm sharing, and I know what it is I'm sharing, and I'm watching the audience for its reactions. Okay, when you're speaking, focus on your audience, right? We're there to focus on carrying the message to the newcomer. Whenever I focused on me, it always came off bad. I was, oh, how good am I going to look? Am I going to say the right thing? And it would discombobulate my thinking. But when I went to the podium and started focusing on the newcomer in the room and thinking, who can I reach? Who can I reach with my message? All the fears and all the problems dissipated, and I became focused on that newcomer. And I didn't get nervous or make mistakes or forget my train of thinking or get flustered. And, you know, it's important to realize you're never going to have a more forgiving audience. They'll clap no matter what you say at the end of your presentation. They want you to do well. The room wants to hear your message. They want you to do well with it. And even if you don't do well, even a bad speaker will get applause at the end of their talk. So you'll never have a more forgiving audience to speak to. Now, here's something I also recommend, is that when you go to the podium, if they're not doing it in the room, record yourself. You know, these smartphones we have are wonderful instruments. They got excellent recording devices. Record yourself. when you go to the front of the room and record your talk so you can listen to it afterwards and go, oh, I really like the way I said that. Oh, that really worked. Well, that didn't work. You know, it's important feedback for after your presentation. That's a good use of critically thinking about how well your presentation came across. Now, I'll share a quick little story with you. It's a little bit self-seeking, but I remember I was asked to do a share in St. Catharines, Ontario, which is about 2 hours out of Toronto here. It was a CA meeting. And I was the lead speaker, and I knew it was a pretty good share I was going to do. So I recorded myself. I went to the front of the room and I did my talk and I recorded it. And afterwards I listened to it. And I thought, this is a really good share. So at that time, this was 2008, XA Speakers, which was an Icelandic hub of keynote speakers. You get keynote speakers from all the fellowship, AA, CA, NA, Al-Anon, CODA, SLAW, the whole works were there, all the different speakers. So I called them up and I said, I just heard the most incredible speaker. You got to get this guy's MP3 on your platform. So they said, well, send it in. So I fired off my MP3. They uploaded it, and you know, now it's been downloaded some 20,000 times, and I've had invitations all around the world as a result of it. So you never, you know, record yourself. You might really be impressed with what it is you have to say. And of course, you want to listen to yourself out afterwards because it's important feedback for understanding what's working, what's flowing, and what doesn't work. As I said earlier, remember, you'll never have a more forgiving audience. Share from the I perspective and avoid using you language. You need to do this. You need to do that. You should be doing this. You should do that. You know, it comes across as very preachy. But when you share from the I perspective, I did this. I experienced that. I was able to do this. It's yours. It's your story. It's your message. No one can take that away from you with the I perspective. So I suggest you avoid using the you language. Sometimes I'll use we language to be inclusive in the message, but most of the time I'm speaking from the I perspective. And of course, the last thing is to have fun. Speaking is when you're comfortable at the podium and you know your talk, you can have a lot of fun when the fears dissipate, and that allows you to be spontaneous. Sometimes something you'll be sharing and you'll get an idea to inject something at this point, and it's a lot of fun carrying the message. And you know, when you get, there's a special thing that can sometimes happen when you're doing it's not so much on Zoom, it's hard to get it on Zoom, but when you're doing it live in person, you know. There's moments in some of the shares I've done over the years where you get a rapport. Musicians and stage performers get this, where you get a connection with your audience, and the audience is really connected with you, and they're feeding you with their enthusiasm and their laughter and their acknowledgement, and you're feeding them with this message, and you get this synergy. And man, it's really good dope when you get that kind of reaction going on when you're in an in-person meeting, and it's a lot of fun. Okay, 5 ways to conduct yourself when speaking virtually or in person. Now, virtual meetings. I love Zoom. I don't have to do any traveling with Zoom. It's cheaper, I find, for the fellowship. When the pandemic hit and the Zoom platform came along, all of a sudden, fellowships around the world were able to, through a very inexpensive platform, basically it's a $20 a month license, could access speakers anywhere in the world. I've done well over 600 keynote shares since COVID came about, and a lot of meetings went virtual, and they were able to access me through this amazing platform. And there's a lot of neat things you can do on the Zoom platform that you really can't do in person. So they're kind of two different styles of presenting your message. So in a virtual meeting, before you present, take a look at yourself in the mirror on camera. Make sure you have your close-up personal face on, you know. Women, you know, sometimes attention to makeup. My wife's a keynote speaker. My wife's the same age as I am. We're both 66. And when I showed her this little switch on Zoom where you can soften your image, man, she just loved that. She was able to take years off her face just by sliding the adjustment in the video, this thing you toggle to make a softer look. She really loved that. You know, today I like to get dressed up. So, you know, I put on a tux and a bow tie, and I got my stage background, you know, to have fun and, you know, to be in the into the groove of the virtual meeting. When you present in virtual, it's ideal to sit comfortably in your chair. I don't recommend you stand or you're on a phone walking around. Sit comfortably, focus on your camera, and make eye contact with your camera. And I recommend you use a laptop or a desktop computer rather than your phone. Make sure your screen is tilted correctly. Sometimes I'll see people speaking and they'll be holding their phone in such a way, and all I see is their nostrils. Right? Or if the camera's too high, you see the top of their head, right? The other thing you want to do in Zoom too, and I do this, is you want to watch the facial expressions of your audience to see that they're engaged, they're smiling, you know, they're laughing. Like I'm watching Sarah, you know, I kind of focus on Sarah because she's just such a wonderful audience. She's smiling, she's nodding, you know, and that gets me in the groove too. So watch your audience. Pay attention to what your audience is doing. And of course, you'll want to smile and speak clearly and modulate your tempo and your voice when you're presenting virtual. Sometimes in virtual, I got to be a little more emotive. I got a little bit more exaggerated because Zoom is a passive medium. And a lot of rooms have using Zoom have turned their meetings into recovery TV. And I see people falling asleep on their couch or their bed, or, you know, they're busy doing the dishes or something, you know, it becomes recovery TV. So when I speak in Zoom, I'm really trying to be dynamic and engaging to grab their focus. Now, in-person meetings, I think it behooves us to be well-groomed and dress appropriately. You know, ties, you know, for men, you know, shirt, tie, you know, that might be over the top, but some meetings like to see that. I generally wear a nice shirt, a sports jacket, nice slacks when I speak in person. You want to, when you go to the podium, sometimes there's not a podium, but most of the time there's a podium. You want to stand in one place, plant your feet firmly in front of your podium or where your mic is, make eye contact with someone in the audience, speak to that person. Look directly at them. When I'm in person, I look directly at the person and I speak to them, make eye contact. And then after, you know, after a certain time, I move on to the next person and I pinpoint different people throughout the audience, in the back, in the front, off to the side, etc. And I speak to them directly, make eye contact with your audience. If no mic is present, sometimes you'll go to a room and there's no mic. You literally got to enunciate your share in a certain size room. So when I speak in a meeting, I'm speaking to the people at the back of the room so everybody can hear me. You know, basically say it loud, say it proud. You don't want to be whispering your message down the well. And again, take note of your audience's engagement. Are they engaged? Are they smiling? Are they laughing? Are they nodding their heads? Smile and speak clearly. And once again, you know, you modulate your talk for, you know, to keep them engaged, keep them interested, and so forth. Okay. Where am I here? There we go. Okay. Three benefits of speaking. Number one benefit of speaking to an audience, whether it's at a meeting or a convention or a roundup, it fulfills our tradition five, our primary purpose to carry the message in CA, our hope, our faith, our courage, AA, our experience, strength, and hope, etc., to the addict who still suffers. Our purpose. Our overall purpose for being a member of a 12-step fellowship is to be of maximum service to God and our fellow human beings. And meetings, I always think meetings should be a pep rally about the solution. There is a solution. That's what we're here to talk about. That's what gets me excited. There's a way out of the hole. There's a spiritual way of living, a spiritual moral approach that lets me easily control my desire to drink, use, or act out. I'm fulfilling that fifth tradition. Everything we do in the 12-step fellowship, whether it's at the group level, the district level, the area level, even at the world services level, everything we do is designed to do one thing, and that's to carry the message to the addict who still suffers. So let's communicate that. There is a solution. Let's impart that, you know, experience, strength, and hope that there is a way out of our predicament here. Okay. Another benefit. By sharing your story, it reinforces our identity as 12-step members. You know, when I went to university, one of my professors had done a longitudinal study of Food Addicts Anonymous, and she was in her PhD, she looked at the different genres of speakers, the different genre of narratives. And like most 12-step fellowships, there were two genres, the recovering addict versus the recovered addict. And she found that recovery stories were consequential for the person's experience of recovery, since it seemed in these narratives that the telling and the retelling of this empowered, recovered narrative with its clear beginning, its turning point, and the favorable results of the new life were significantly critical for a stable and consistent recovery. She found that such narration of the recovered addict not only facilitated the member's constant affiliation and appropriation with the 12-step narrative, but they showed consistent abstinency. So how you identify in your share as a member can have a bearing on your own recovery. It was a fascinating, if anyone likes reading journals, like academic articles, and you want to read this article for yourself, just drop me a note and I'll send it to you. Alternatively, she found in the study of these recovery narratives that the telling and retelling of the ambiguous, always recovering narrative, "Hi, I'm Cameron, I'm a recovering addict," where I question the received spiritual principles, I ponder what she called hypothetical life past, not actually pursued. I envision that, you know, abstinent is both good and bad. The old life wasn't necessarily a bad one. The new life isn't generally a good one. And what she found in these narratives and the follow-up on the longitudinal study was that these people who identified as recovering, "I'm always an arm's length away from the next drink. I'm always sick. I'm always going to be an addict, an acting out addict." She found that this group of speakers could not maintain consistent abstinency. It really was a fascinating article. Now, I know I'm getting a little heady and a little academic here, but again, I'll publish the slideshow and you'll have this note that you can read over. The other benefit to speaking is that, you know, central to the 12-step recovery culture, because we have a culture, right, is the personal story of the recovered addict. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Now, a member's personal story reinforces this contrived figure world of 12-step recovery. And these narratives create boundaries that structure and empower our 12-step recovery culture. And it's by sharing our personal story of what we used to be like, members identify as, "Hey, I'm like you, you're like me." And their war stories convey an important criteria for potential members to identify and label themselves. As I said, "Hey, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore." And this is the power of our story. Furthermore, personal testimonies are significant to the newcomer because the storyline of the recovered addicts objectify the central cultural elements of a 12-step world. The importance of attending meetings, getting a sponsor, helping other suffering addicts, doing service work for your 12-step group. And it's by listening to the narratives of recovered members, newcomers learn the culture of what 12-step recovery is all about. The newcomer learns a model of a model of the 12-step testimonial by listening to other members and through the telling of their own story, the newcomer comes to understand their own life as a member of the 12-step program. And the 12-step rhetorical language, it provides an attractive element. Hey, I want what you got. That connects the newcomer to the 12-step culture, assures them that the drinking, using, or acting problem can be solved, resulting in behavioral transformations of newcomers. You know, up until the 80s, like in the 70s especially, it got so bad in AA that it was just all open discussion topics. The big book was but a doorstop in the meetings. And we got so far away from the actual message that you were probably more likely to sober up on your own accord than to hang around the rooms. And then it was all about the drunkalogue, long-winded war stories. And of course, the newcomer hears that and thinks, oh, well, that's what I should be doing too. So we got a whole generation of drunkalogue speakers. Now, fortunately, since Joe and Charlie came about in the 1980s and then the proliferation of other big book sponsors throughout the 90s, like the Muckers in Toronto, Wally P with the Back to Basics, Cliff Bishop and Chris R and Mark Houston out of Texas with Primary Purpose Groups, and Billy S on the East Coast with the Big Book Step Study. In England, you've got Richard E and Richmond Group and their approach to the big book. And now we've got these very strong recovered messages, and newcomers are learning, oh, that's what I should be doing. And that's what our culture is all about. So how you share your talk has a tremendous bearing on the newcomer's experience. The third thing about speaking is Bill suddenly realized that in order to save himself, he must carry the message to another alcoholic. It's important for the newcomer to realize that our attempt to pass this message, to convey this message of experience, strength, and hope on them, it plays a vital part in my recovery. And you're actually helping me more than, you know, I'm helping them. It's kind of a ripoff. You know, I hear sometimes in the room, as a message, oh, this is a selfish program. I got to work on me first. You know, I never see those people hang around the rooms long. It's not a selfish program. It's about being of maximum service to God and your fellow human beings, to be of service, to be helpful. And every time I've gone through the work or spoken, I've learned something new about myself. I've learned something new about newcomers. I've learned something new about the program. So it is a process that has been giving to me generously for 20 years. Okay, three key elements for a compelling story. Now, what I love about the big book, it's so instructional, and it really does give us clear-cut instructions on how we convey our message to those that suffer. Number one is structure. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like. Not what we were, not what it was like, what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like now. And then there's a substance to our message. And that is a message that can interest and hold these alcoholic or addicted people, must have depth and weight. What's the one thing? Here's the one hair that we always are splitting. The one thing we'd all love to be able to do, but can't, which binds us together, whether you're a drug addict, an alcoholic, or you're a sex addict, food addict, cutter, hoarder, codependent, whatever. The one thing I really would love to do, but can't, is control it. I have no control, lack of power, lack of control. That's the message of what we used to be like. That's the message that identifies me with those in the rooms. Hey, I'm like you, you're like me. I got no power either. I have no control. And the outcome is we believe that by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems to the newcomer, they'll be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. So we want to carry the message, not the wreckage. We want to avoid drunkalogues and junky pride stories. And as I said earlier, I already know how to drink and use. I'm an expert at it. What I don't know is a solution. And so often I've seen meetings turn into Oprah Winefests, you know, group therapy without a therapist, right? And they're awful. You know, by the end of the meeting, there's no hope, there's no faith, there's no courage. I'm a psychological casualty. I'm ready to put a bullet in my head, or worse yet, a bullet in someone else's head. And now I need a meeting to fix the meeting I was supposed to get that at. There's far too many of them out there. They carry the message, not the wreckage. The junkie pride. Let me tell you what kind of an addict I really was. And they're all this bravado about how bad they were. You know, that's not conducive to the message we're here to carry. Three ways to win the newcomer's confidence. Number one, we're ex-problematics. That's very compelling to someone who wants to stop but can't stop, and they meet you and you have stopped. That's compelling. That's number one for winning the newcomer's confidence. My name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict who doesn't drink or use, and I haven't done so for 20 years. That's compelling to someone who wants to stop but can't. Second, I've got a solution. I got a way out. That's very compelling. And I'm going to share it with you. And it's not going to cost you anything other than your willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness. And three, I'm properly armed with the facts about myself. I know what it's like to be an addict. I know what it's like to live in that inescapable hole where I'm doomed to pursue my love of my drinking and using to the gates of insanity or death. And with those three things in place, we can generally win the confidence of another addict in just a few hours. But until that understanding is reached, nothing can be accomplished. They will not be motivated to take your advice. That's why, we often don't listen deeply to the counselors or the therapists or our church leaders or what have you, because they don't know what it's like to be us. The anthropologists refer to us as wounded healers. We've been wounded by our addiction and we have found a way through it. We have healed. And that earns us the right to carry the message to those that suffer. And of course, the message is the good news. There is a way out. Three types of shares. These are, there may be other variations of this, but there's generally three types of shares that we see in the room. There's the very short share where you got a minute or less just to introduce yourself. This is an opportunity for you to carry a message. Then sometimes when I see this a lot in AA here in Ontario, when someone is chairing a meeting, they have to qualify as the chair. They qualify as a member. And this is a 3 minute or less share. It's kind of like the elevator talk. And then there's the main share where we share our hope, faith, and courage, which could be a short share from 15 to 20 minutes or to as long as 60 minutes. Now, one of the things I recommend, and this is another reason why you structure your share and you write it down, is sometimes I've been invited to a meeting. The host has told me I've got 40 minutes to share. But because it's a birthday and all the different, accolades and things that they've been doing with the birthday, the person who's celebrating their birthday, now it comes time for me to share, and they've only got 20 minutes left. Now, if you're thinking of a 40-minute share and all you got is 20, that's going to be really unnerving. That's going to create some apprehension and some tension. So, because I know what I want to say, I can add or subtract from my presentation already in my mind. So I can deliver it in 15 to 20 minutes. I can deliver a 30-minute presentation. I can deliver a 40-minute presentation. I can deliver a 60-minute presentation. And I know what elements I can add or not add depending on the time frame that I'm asked to speak in. So you want to be flexible with your share. That's why it's so important to know what it is you want to share rather than stream of consciousness. Sometimes when I'm asked to share, I will ask the host for a minimum of 30 minutes. I've learned to do it in certain contexts. You know, if it's like a topic meeting and they want me to speak about, let's say, step three, and I've only got 15 or 20 minutes, I can deal with it there. But if they want me to share my story of my experience, strength, and hope, 30 minutes is my minimum, and ideally 40 minutes. So sometimes I will ask the host, can I have 30 minutes? Can I have 40 minutes? And it's okay to ask your host for some requirements as the speaker. I don't think there's a problem with doing that. You know, I'm not, I don't want to come across like a prima donna because that's not what I'm here to do. But there are times I think the message is important. And out of respect for what it is I wish to share and reach the newcomer with, I will ask for a certain amount of time to do so. But I'm always prepared that things could go sideways. And now I've only got 20 minutes or 15. So I'm prepared in any event. Introducing ourselves. Now, you can have a lot of fun at introducing yourself. Now, here are some of the ways I've introduced myself, and I have a lot of fun with it. You know, the first one is, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an addict. Now, that's the most common thing you hear in the room. And I get it. Hey, I'm an addict. And other people, and maybe newcomers are there for the first time, think, oh, there's addicts in the room. That person says they're an addict. Well, I'm an addict. And that's okay. But I think that's the bare minimum. It really doesn't tell me a lot about you. Now, the one I do not use is, my name's Cameron, I'm a recovering addict. I'm not a fan of that. I know some programs encourage that, treatment centers encourage that. I'm not a fan of it because, you know, that longitudinal study where they found the recovering addict couldn't maintain consistent abstinency gave me mind to think about that a lot. So I don't use that particular introduction. I hear this a lot in Toronto. Hi, my name's Cameron. I'm a recovered addict. Now, that's fine. Some people will take umbrage to the word recovered, although it mentions 16 times in the big book that we've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. But it behooves us, if we do get a chance to share, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm a recovered addict. And then add on to it what I mean by that. By recovered, I mean I have been separated from that merciless obsession to drink, use, or act out. I've connected to a power that lets me easily control my desire to drink or use, and hence I've recovered from that seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. You can do that. That adds so much more depth and weight to your introduction. Another way I like to introduce myself and have fun with it is, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. And again, like the recovered addict, what I mean by that, as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, and that ties into this this next phrase, I'm an addict and an alcoholic who doesn't use or drink. Now, that's not said a lot in the rooms, but it gets people thinking, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use anymore. That signifies not only who and what I am, but also what I'm like today. And it signifies what I believe, what separates the members from the rounders. A member of Alcoholics Anonymous is someone who doesn't drink. If you're still drinking, you're just an alcoholic. But a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic who doesn't drink. That's the difference in membership. That, to me, is what membership implies. So when I get a chance to introduce myself, I'm having fun with the audience. I call it trolling for dickweeds. I'm baiting the audience. I'm trying to see who's listening and going, hey, I don't know what Cameron's got, but I wouldn't mind a piece of it, right? And I pick up prospects all over the place. Another one is, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm an addict who knows how to stop. If I'm in a room full of blue hairs, not to poke fun at the elders of our meetings, but sometimes I'll go to a real stodgy blue hair meeting and everyone's stiff and formal and lots of saints and virgins. And I'll go, hi, my name's Cameron, intelligent agent, spearhead of God's ever advancing creation. It's great to be here. And the old timer, oh, who's he think he is? That sounds like a lot of ego, and, you know, gets them all wound up, but it gets their attention. Lately, I've been sharing sometimes at meetings, and I'm definitely having fun when I do this. Sometimes in CA also, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm the most powerful member. I'm the most powerful CA member in the world. And people go, what? Because I'm having fun. I'm poking my audience. The other one I've been using lately, and I heard Mark Houston say it once before he passed. He goes, my name is Cameron, and I'm a god that shits. And that really, people go, what? Because it's a double entendre. I'm playing the spiritual being, but I'm also grounded to this secular profane world. And so, but again, the whole thing is, in it, you have an opportunity when it most meetings ask you to introduce yourself. And if you get that chance, have some fun with it. It's a chance to reach out to someone who's listening in the room. Wow, that person doesn't talk like the rest of them. I think I want what that person has. Qualifying as an addict. What qualifies you to share a message? What are the facts about yourself? What can you say in 3 minutes or less that will persuade those in the meeting to say, hey, yes, I'm like you, you're like me, but you don't do it anymore. Now, some key elements to qualifying is one, our lack of power. What am I like? Lack of power, lack of control. We want to demonstrate the old self versus the new self. And, you know, the introduction is part of that, but then we can expand on it. So, for example, often when I'm asked to qualify in 3 minutes or less, my name's Cameron. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. For 26 years, from morning, noon, and night, from the age of 20 to age of 46, I drank and used. And for the most part, it was fun. But then it became fun with problems. And then in the end, it was nothing but problems. And I wanted to stop. And I found I couldn't because I got this liar that lives in my head that loves the effect created by alcohol and drugs. And it's always working on a new reason, new excuses as to why this time when I drink or use, somehow, some way, I'm going to be able to control and use it and do it. And even when I don't want to do it, the liar would always win the argument. And that would put me on in the progressiveness of my illness. When I would drink, I'd like to tell you, I'm just going to go to the pub, have a pint, maybe a bourbon, and go home. But once I start, I have no idea what it's going to look like because my addiction pattern takes on what's called the spree, where I have no idea how long it's going to last. Could go on for a day, a week, a month, a year, or longer. I don't know. And then at some point, I'm full of so much horror and remorse. I come up for a moment of air and say, I got to stop. And I make a firm resolution not to do it again. We've all done that coming off a spree, right? Make a resolution not to do it again. But here's the problem. I don't know how to live with it. I don't know how to live without it. So I go to meetings and I try and hear a message. But if I'm in one of those open discussion meetings or open discussing meetings that I call it, where there's no message, I sit there and I enter into what's called sobriety. And I start getting restless, irritable, discontented, bored, depressed. That activates the liar and says, hey, we need our old solution. That's bourbon and coke. And the liar always wins the argument, and I succumb to the desire, and out I go, pursuing the love of my addiction to the gates of insanity or death. Yet as a member of Cocaine Anonymous, it's been 20 years since I've had a drink or a drug. How is that possible? Because I met someone in the rooms armed with the facts about themselves. They had a solution, the 12 steps, the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a generosity of spirit. And they showed me a way out of that hole, and life has been stellar ever since. That's a three-minute talk. A lot covered in that 3 minutes. But when I qualify like that, people are hearing and they're going, you know, there's a lot of meat and potatoes and you can deliver in just 3 minutes. So that's qualifying. And then of course there's the main speaker share. This is your full-blown everything about you share, usually 30 to 40 minutes, sometimes an hour, depending on the fellowship and the room you're in. So we open with have your introduction. Open, introduce yourself. Then you want to share what you used to be like. This is where we tell an effective war story, where we win the newcomer's confidence. Then we want to share what happened, how you hit bottom, how you reached that turning point where you some people call it the jumping off place, the moment of clarity, how you found and worked a particular solution. And then you want to share what you're like today. Talk about the promises filled. Talk about how life has taken on new meaning, how we found the fellowship we crave. And then, of course, you want to close your talk. Now, step one and five, opening and closing, that's the first thing you do is open. Last thing you do is close. Now, points two, three, and four, you can mix up. Often I'll share what I used to be like. Then I'll share what my life is like today. And then I go to point three and share what has happened. But you can mix it up. You can have some fun with it. It doesn't have to be a straight one through five share. You can do one. You can go to four. You can go to three, go to two, or whatever works. Okay. So let's talk about opening your share. Introduce yourself. When I introduce myself, as I said, hi, my name's Cameron. I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous. I'm an alcoholic addict, doesn't drink or use. Now, tell a humorous analogy or a short story. Now, some of you have heard me share. I have two stories that I share. I talk about going in the rooms and asking people, are you working a program? People tell me, yeah, they go to meetings. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with someone? Yeah, I got a sponsor. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Are you working with newcomers? Newcomers, I'm a newcomer. This is a selfish program. That's one story I tell to set up my presentation. The other one I share is about the addict down in the hole that's trying to escape, and family members try to help them. The church community tries to help them, the medical community and the treatment center community, and he stays stuck in his hole. That's another story that I share to set up my talk. You can have some fun. You can always open up with a joke if you like. And there's lots of recovery jokes online. So if you want to open with a joke, that can be fun. I have one when I'm in CA. So a hard user and a real addict goes to the dealer to buy some crack. And the dealer says, oh man, you're not going to believe it, but I got this magic eight ball of crack cocaine. It's absolutely the blingest of the bling. It'll give you a ringer like nothing else. And here's the thing about it. No matter how much you chip off the eight ball, it never goes down in size or volume. And the hard user says, well, I'll take one of those. But the real addict says, you better give me three. Right, Vicky? Right? So you can have some fun, with a joke. And of course, big book quotes always work. You know, one of my favorite big book quotes, because I talk about working with others and the importance of working with others and all the efficacy of our program is working with others. All I could open with on page 89 of our big book says, my mind just went blank. There you go. Practical experience shows us that nothing so much as ensures immunity as intensive work with other addicts. It works when all other activities fail, right? I'll sometimes open with that quote because I'm carrying a working with others type of message. Sometimes when I'm asked to do step four talk, I'll open with page 125 where it says, most alcoholics, most addicts are sensitive people. It takes a long time to overcome this serious handicap. And that sets the context of why inventory is so important, because it helps me overcome my resentments, my fears, and my harms to others. So there's three different ways you can open your share, and you can have fun with it. There's a huge variation of what you can play with. So no one's talk's all going to sound the same. You know, lots of different big book quotes you could draw on, lots of humorous analogies or stories. And of course, introducing yourself in a fun way. Okay, what we used to be like. This is our war story. How do we share a war story that hits home? Now, a lot of people, when I hear them do their story, they spend, if they got 45 minutes to share, the first 40 minutes is their war story. And they go, and then I found the rooms and I got well and life is good. And thank you so much. You know, like 30 seconds on what they're like, you know, and it's all about the war story. War story is important. But it only occupies, you know, about a third of my probably less than a third, you know, on a 40 minute presentation, 10 to 15 minutes on what I used to be like, another 10 minutes on what my life is like today. And the rest of the program, the rest of my share is on what happened. So how should we tell our war story? And again, our big book gives us specific instructions on how to do that. We tell the newcomer enough about our drinking, our using, our acting out, habits, symptoms, and experiences, encourage them to speak of themselves. Now, in a share, you're not going to get feedback from your audience that directly, but you can share about, you know, your drinking habits and experiences, right? And when I drink bourbon and I'm an everyday drinker. You know, when I use cocaine, I use a needle. I like the needle. You know, I smoke copious amounts of marijuana, right? So, and I did so for 26 years, morning, noon, and night from the age of 20 to 26. Tell them how baffled you were, how you finally learned that you were sick. I tell this story when I illustrate this point. I used to work the financial districts of Toronto, and Monday to Friday, I'm in a three-piece pinstripe suit, this back in the 80s. And every Friday, there would always be a party at someone's house, very posh party, luxurious home or condominium someone would have a party at. And I remember going to this party, and I'm in my three-piece suit. Other men, the other members of the office were in their suits. The women were all in their finest business attire. And there's a lot of drinking going on. And in the 80s, there was a lot of cocaine. So I'm sitting on the sofa, and this person says to me, "Would you like to do a few lines of coke?" I said, "Absolutely." So as he's cutting me out my lines, I take off my suit jacket, I roll up my sleeve, and my arm is all coated in track marks from intravenous usage, and I put a needle and a spoon on the table, and the party stopped. It went dead quiet. And the hostess walks up to me and goes, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going to do my lines." She goes, "You can't shoot up like a junkie in the middle of our posh little soiree here." I said, "What? You're judging me on my delivery system? Is this what we're talking about?" And I was politely asked to leave and escorted to the door. I took my lines with me, by the way. But as I'm walking out the door, I'm thinking, I don't use like these people. What? There's something different about the way I approach my drug use. And I was beginning to crystallize that something wasn't quite right. We want to give them an account of the struggles you made to stop. So much I hear is about how I drank, how much I drank, how much I used, so forth. That's not what is important about our war story. What's important about our war story is all the ways we tried to stop and failed us. I tried willpower. I tried solemn promises and oaths. I tried controlled using. I used to say, "I'm only here for a gram," and my dealer would laugh at me. I've tried therapy, counseling. I've tried detoxing. I've tried spiritual retreats. I've tried giving my money to someone. I've tried reading self-help books. I've been to personal development courses. I tried all these things, and they all failed to hold me in check. Now, that's something everyone relates to. All addicts relate to the failed strategy. So as a point of identification, it can be very powerful. And then four, show the newcomer how the mental twist, how my mind always goes to the first drink or drug. And that's why I use the analogy of the liar. Our big book talks about the mental blank spot, the strange phenomenon that parallels our sound reasoning that fails to hold us in check. I talk about the liar. And everyone gets the liar that lives in their head, convincing them this time when they drink, use, or act out, they're going to somehow, some way get away with it, control it, and enjoy it. And the liar always wins the argument. Every addict gets that. They understand that, and they can relate to that. So again, I'm trying to communicate to the persons who's suffering in a manner that they get it. And I think sometimes analogies work better. We could quote the big book. I'm quoting the big book here, but I think quoting and then backing it up with your own experience and a powerful analogy or metaphor or aphorism really, really helps to cement the point in your share. What happened? Now, I think this is the most important part of our talk. What happened for you to go from where you were to where you are today? So you want to tell them exactly what happened. You see, 12-step is different from the secular human approaches. It's not psychological. It's not secular. It's not behavioral modification. It is a spiritual, moral approach to the efficacy of our addiction. So I'm going to stress the spiritual component freely. Now, again, depending on my audience, and I'll speak one-on-one here, when I'm working with atheists, I'll talk about the spiritual feature in the context of higher consciousness. I don't know of anyone that's opposed to higher consciousness. If I'm speaking with Christians, I'll talk Jesus. If I'm speaking with Jews, Hashem. If I'm speaking with Aboriginals, Great Spirit, Muslims, Allah. I don't care what you call it, but again, I'm mindful of the audience. I'm using the vernacular that they can relate to and being flexible with that. Describe your last bottom, your jumping off place, that turning point. So when I describe this, My sobriety date is November 21st, 2003. Now, on October 31st, Halloween, I'm fishing for brown trout. I caught two that day. Beautiful fish, about 18 inches. I'm drinking cold Coronas, beers, and I'm smoking $400 an ounce dope. And I'm miserable inside and out on this gorgeous day in this beautiful setting. And I thought, I don't want to do this anymore. 26 years of this. I'm so done. I've burned my life to the ground. Nobody wants to be around me. My kids don't want anything to do with me. My wife has basically resigned any relationship with me. I got liver disease. This sucks. And I want to go a different way. And I remember going home and telling my wife, I'm going to go in the rooms of AA. And I remember her sobbing. And I got such a visceral hit of how much damage I had done to my family at that moment. And I went into the rooms and I started the program. Well, my sobriety date's November 21st, not October 31st. Why? Because on November 20th, I got invited to the food show here in Toronto, and they were doing beers from around the world. Now, interesting enough, you only got a little lick of the beer. They were, you know, you've all seen communion cups. So like they're little tiny cups, and they put a little bit of beer in it, and you got a sip. It wasn't even a drink. It was not even a sip. And I thought, oh, well, that can't hurt me. Of course, when you drink 400 of them, it kind of adds up. So my sobriety date is November 21st as opposed to November 3rd. That was my last bottom. And, you know, one thing about the bottom, it wasn't a physical bottom. It wasn't a mental or emotional bottom. It was a spiritual bottom. I was bankrupt. I was staring into the abyss. And all that was staring back was the blackness of the abyss. And it was awful. And that's what motivated me to seek a solution in the room. Talk about how you found your sponsor. I dried out in the rooms for 8 months in those open, disgusting meetings. And it was 8 months in. And I was sharing at a meeting, sharing some crap about the day. And it was miserable sharing. And I was miserable. And I'm leaving. I think if this is what my life is going to be like in recovery, 8 months in, day in and day out doing this stuff, I'd rather drink. And I was leaving to drink. And a guy grabbed me. He says, Cameron, I'm watching you die. Let me show you how to work a program. And we didn't go to another meeting. We went to a coffee shop, took out big books, started reading instructions. And this man changed my life forever. That's how I found my sponsor. I started attending meetings. Now, I do one meeting a week. That's my frequency. Now, some may do more. Some may do it every day. My frequency is a meeting a week because I've got a busy life with family and children and so forth. And the whole point of recovery was to be of value and service to my family. So I attend one meeting a week. I do sometimes more when I'm asked to speak. And I started the step work with this fellow, and I started going to meetings, and then I started working with others. I was inspired to work with others by Wally P, who wrote Back to Basics, and Chris R out of Austin, Texas, with his kind of fiery big book approach. And then I got involved in service. The first thing it is, I started a meeting, and with a meeting, I started attending area as a GSR. And learning about area, then I got involved in area. I served on 9 conventions. I've done most of the standing committee chair positions. Then I got elected as a delegate, and I went to World Services and got involved at the world level. I am currently the World Archivist for Cocaine Anonymous. I'm also the Southern Ontario Archivist, and I'm also the online service area delegate, although it's my last year on the conference floor. I rotate out, and I'm the online service area archive chair. And I love being of service. You know, service is icing on the cake. You get to take the principles of our recovery. You get to take the principles of the traditions and the principles of our concept, and you actualize those principles at the group level, the district level, the area level, the world level, and you reach out and you carry a message. And it's icing on the cake. If you're not involved in service, I highly recommend it. Predicated that you're well-grounded on your recovery program, steps 1 to 12, and grounded in your traditions, which is the unity and the fabulous nature of our fellowship. Okay, what we're like now. This is your bragging rights. This is your chance to really brag and have some fun at sharing It's great being in recovery. I love being a member of the 12-step program. My life, I've done more in the last 20 years than I did in the first 46 years of my life. You know, the first thing that I got, and this is the minimum the program gives us, is sobriety. I can easily control my desire to drink, use, or act out because I've plugged into a power that lets me do that. And after 6 years, my liver went back to normal. I rebuilt my marriage with my wife. My wife and I are celebrating 34 years of marriage this year. Man, she's my best friend, my confidant, my soulmate, my business partner. It's like marbled meat. I don't know where she begins and ends and where I begin and end in our relationship. And we're both very independent people, but when we come together, there's an interdependence where the two halves, the whole is greater than the two halves. It's really magical. And the program gave me that. I have the love and trust of my children. I travel around the world, speak. I was in Denmark last year. I was in the UK recently. I've been to Spain, Sweden, you know, all across America, Canada. Man, it's a fabulous life. I went back to university in my 50s and graduated at the top of my class at the 10th ranked Ivy League university in the world, University of Toronto, Medical Anthropology and Religions. It is a stellar life living this program. So this is your chance to brag about what you're doing, how the program has worked in your life, because that's why we do it. You know, there's a payoff to living a spiritual, moral way of living. And then you talk about the fellowship you found. You know, I go to the meetings for two reasons. One, for the camaraderie of people like yourselves working your program, wanting to be of usefulness to others who suffer. I love that camaraderie. It reinforces my faith. I see God working through you, doing for you what you could not normally do for yourself. And that reinforces my faith. I'm very protective of my faith. And I cleave to that higher power deep down within. And that motivates me to do the work, which yields the promises. And I love the fellowship. You know, I have so much fun in the fellowship. I have conversations in the fellowship that I can't have with the muggles. You know, I call them muggles, not normies, non-addict, you know, Harry Potter term for non-wizard. Sometimes if I'm in a room, like a secular room, you know, maybe my wife's friends or people at the church, my wife's a Baptist, and I forget I'm amongst the normies and I share something, and all of a sudden there's awkward silence. Oh my God, did he really just say that? Whereas with addicts, man, we have such rich and diverse and such interesting conversations and experiences. You know, it's funny when you hear a speaker share and they're sharing an aspect of the war story, and then and sometimes there's family members there and they're literally horrified. They're in shock about what this person went through, but all of us, we're laughing at what they're sharing, and they're gobsmacked. Why are you laughing? Because we understand the journey through our war story. So, I love the fellowship. And then lastly, you know, a signature. I have a signature sign off. Some of you have heard me when I share, you know, depending on what I'm sharing about, I always sign off. For example, if I'm sharing about, you know, the program, I'll close with something like, you know, working a 12-step program is not a sprint, it's a marathon for life, and I'm for that. How about you? That's my signature sign off. I'm for that. How about you? You can close with a short story again. I usually close by completing the story of the addict down in the hole, and I talk about what we should do now that we're armed with the facts about ourselves. We have a common solution. We jump in the hole with the addict, and they're baffled. Now we're both in the hole, but no, we can turn to our suffering addict with a wink in our eye and say, "It's okay. I've been here before. I got a way out for more experience, strength, and out hope." A way out to walk hand in hand with the sunlight of the spirit, a way out, be intelligent agent, spearheads of God's ever advancing creation. I'm for that. How about you? And I sign off. And you can sign off with a big book quote. Again, there's all kinds of great quotes that can resonate with the share that you just delivered, and you can close with a quote. And we do our and create a signature sign off. People know it's you that's speaking. And that's how we structure I believe how we can be effective speakers with the sole purpose of reaching the newcomer who says, hey, I'm like you, you're like me, you don't do it anymore. I want what this program has to offer. And we get that person on that magical journey of 12 steps. And just to signify how I close off, I'm for that. How about you? Okay. If you find this workshop is useful, I'm going to, we've been recording it. I will post the recording of this presentation on the website within the next couple hours, along with this slideshow for your benefit to download and go over it at your leisure. But if you find there's value there, please consider making a seventh donation, 20, 10, 5. The link there, CA Service Sponsorship. .org. You can go to our, we use PayPal, so it'll go to a PayPal account. You don't need to have a PayPal account to give. You can do it by credit card. PayPal will process it. Or if you have a PayPal account, you can do it through your own PayPal account. And lastly, I look forward, and I really mean this, I look forward to hearing your share, your talk at the next 12-step recovery meeting or convention. If any one of you would like to work one-on-one, you give me a call. I'll post my details in the chat. We can set it up where I record you. We can talk about it, make suggestions. You go away and work on it. Come back a second time. We'll record you again. And you can, you know, get in, take your talk to a whole new level. And I'm for that. How about you? And that's how we do it at CA Service Sponsorship. Thank you so much, everybody, for attending. Really appreciate it. It's always fun to carry a message.
Thank you, Cameron.
Thank you, Francine.
Thank you, Cameron.
And I'll leave the room open if there's anyone here who has any questions or would like to, you know, share a thought or two.
Thanks, Cameron.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Cameron.
Yeah, it's a fun, I love doing this, Sharon.
There's still people coming in.
Yeah, maybe they got the time all whacked out, but we can let everyone know that we'll post the, we can post the presentation online for those that missed it. Any questions from anyone? Any thoughts? Any concerns? Any, oh my God, I can't believe you said that, Cameron.
Oh my God, I can't believe you said that, Cameron.
Yeah, I can't believe I said
that. There should be more people like you.
And thank you, Sarah. Every presentation I do on Zoom, there's always a godsend like yourself that's just engaged, and it's fun to just talk to that person throughout the presentation. So yeah, you made it fun. Thank you.
Thank you. I always enjoy your meet when you're at a meeting, your enthusiastic and solid message. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay. Yes, bye, everybody. Have a fun day.
Bye, everyone.
Yeah,
thank
it's a
you.
Great day here in the.
Thank you, Cameron. East. Thanks.
Thank you.
Oh, hey, Cameron. Can you put?
Hello, hello. Who am I talking to?
You're talking. Is it Moto?
Moto. That's
Moto.
The name of my
Moto G Pure. What the heck is Moto G Pure? Yes, you're talking to us.
No, it's a phone. It's the name of a phone.
Mm.
But you know, when you said, Cameron, you said so many powerful things that were so helpful. You said something about, oh, I can't live without it. I can't live with it, and I can't live without it. I was saying to myself, that could be applied to almost any addiction, couldn't it? Like codependency or anything.
Absolutely.
You know?
In the process addictions, in drugs and alcohol, it's usually the drugs and alcohol that kills us. But in the process addictions, because I don't know how to live with it and I can't live without it, it ends in suicide with the codependents and the gamblers and the sex and love and fantasy addicts.
Yes.
Right.
Well, yes. I mean, I've been in the SLAA program and avoidance program and all that. I've been in about 8 or 9 programs. But yeah, it just struck me when you said that. I was like, That makes so much sense. You know, as a codependent, I know I've said that to my husband before. I can't live with you, and I can't live without you. That is a codependent addiction, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah,
Because
I
I
love
was
that.
sitting there. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, you're right. And codependency is a nasty addiction.
I know. It's just so old, you know, it's really old. And then because I thought to myself, that's the bottom line, really, of all of it, because I've been in everything but not the drug thing or the alcohol thing or any of that. I never got addicted to that, but it was everything else.
Yeah. Moda, you still there? I love it.
Codependence.
There you are.
And you helped me realize maybe that's my next program, you know?
Well, you
Anyways.
know what? The codependent battle cry is I need you to change so I can feel okay about myself. And that's a lousy position to hold.
Hey,
Yes.
Cameron.
Yes.
Sorry to bother you. Could you post the website where it's going to be, the presentation's going to be,
Yeah, I thought, well,
please?
I mentioned it to Freddie directly, but let me post it to everyone.
Thank you.
There you go. It'll be right on the CA service sponsorship site. I'll do that within the next couple hours.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to be of service today. It was a wonderful event.
Thanks, Francine. And we brought it in. Oh, we got it done in an hour and a half. That went really well.
You had over 70 people at one point.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. You leveled out at 5. That was
Can
really helpful, Cameron. Sorry.
Yeah, go ahead, Pinky.
I was just going to say that was really helpful. It blew my mind a bit because, like, I've always been I've always been told to just let it come through with God. But I'm gonna go away. I'm gonna do some writing, and look at the points in the presentation. And then I'm gonna come back to you if that's all right.
Yeah,
Gonna do a
absolutely.
share out, yeah,
You know,
and
I
we'll
have to, you
be.
know, when they say just let God speak through you, you know, what if you're a Pentecostal and you start speaking in tongues? How the hell are they going to understand you?
And the thing is, when God speaks through me, it's all over the place. It's not structured, and it's yeah, and I lose myself. So yeah, thank you, Cameron, and I'll be speaking to you soon.
Oh, you're
I'm gonna
welcome,
go
Pinky.
now.
And we don't structure it to be stiff and rigid. We
Yeah.
structure it to somewhat so we have an idea of what we want to share. And again, the mind focus is being helpful to the newcomer, right?
Exactly, because I keep when it was shared at the beginning, it's like I have that every time I do share. It's like shit, I forgot to say that. I forgot to say that, and it's like I do need a bit of structure because I just get I run away with myself, you
I
know.
still do that. I'll deliver a share and I know my share inside and out. And sometimes I'll say at the end of it, oh, I wish I had said that or said that. But you know what? It is what it is and it comes out, you know, and
Yeah.
that happens again, you know. But
Yeah.
mindfulness about saying, and sometimes, you know, what's great about Zoom is, you know, you got your notes in front of you. No one knows you're working from notes, but you got your notes right there. So there you go. I love
Oh,
Zoom.
what's good?
The
Can I make a comment, Cameron?
best form of cheat notes. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say, just coming full circle to a question that you asked right at the beginning regarding some of the issues with sharing, some of the fears that. That question just sort of was lingering for me the whole hour and a half that I just sort of really wasn't paying attention to. And it just came full circle right now is that over the years, I found myself to be an average speaker or average communicator in the meetings. And then I think what happened for me is it's the vulnerability piece that people really get to know you when you share, right? You share for a couple of minutes in a meeting. You say what you want, you have some kind of control. When you're up there for half an hour, 40 minutes, you're opening up a little bit and you're like, well, do I really want this person to know this or that? And then your mind tells you, oh, they're like me anyways. They've been through this. You're supposed to help the newcomer you identify. But the truth is, what I came to an awareness today is the reason I sort of backed off of all that, because it was overwhelmingly a lot of attention to me, and people were calling me and they want me to help them and stuff like that. And I realized I'm just a self-seeking, selfish kind of guy that I just didn't want to give that time, right? I just got a life and I got business to run, children to raise, and the truth is that's actually really sad that I came to that awareness that, how did I get it? Somebody spent that time with me, right? And gave me their time and effort to help me get well. So for me not to, for me to give it back in a different way, I can donate financially, I can give rides to people, I can talk to them, but to actually take somebody through the 12 steps is a totally different gamut. So I really want to thank you for this presentation today, because you just gave me a whole different window that I'm looking into that I wasn't aware of.
Well,
So thanks.
you mentioned an interesting point about vulnerability. It just hit me as you were sharing. And I'll have to work it into the presentation in the future. Is discretion? There's a certain amount of discretion we should use in our shares. Remembering, audiences aren't necessarily always spiritually fit. And something
Right.
might be inappropriate to share that's really not meant to be shared in a public forum. I wouldn't encourage
Or
anyone
the way you share it, or the way you
the
share
way
it.
you share it or what you're sharing.
Correct.
We're not there to do a step five in front of the room, right?
Correct. Absolutely.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
Hi, Cameron. You just touched on something that I wanted to ask about, and that's like having a cheat sheet,
Yes.
because that's actually what I've done up until now. Like I write down what I think I want to say, and I think, okay, that comes from God, whatever comes in, and then I practice it so that I can kind of absorb it. And then I write bullet form and I take that with me so that I'm not reading, because I would be afraid to be drawn into the temptation to read. So I just write like the bullets. And I'm always a bit ashamed about that. But my sponsor said, if you were invited to speak, then you need to prepare, and that's showing respect for the people who are coming to listen. But this, you didn't say anything in the presentation. So I just
You know
like
what?
is uh-huh.
You're on Zoom, you can get away with cheat notes to a large degree. I work with them all the time. But I don't have a problem you going to a podium if they have a lectern and you got your notes on what you want to share so you stay on track. I don't see anything wrong with that approach. And anyone who offers criticism, oh, you should just do it, whatever, comes up. I don't necessarily agree with that. You work with your notes if you have to. I've actually pulled out a sheet and read something to the room because I didn't have it committed to memory. And I'm not a big fan of committing things to memory either, because you can have mental blank spots at the podium, or if you forget the sequence of your memory, then you get all discombobulated and it comes out like hell. So, I don't see anything wrong with having cue cards or points when you go to the podium in person, and certainly if you're on Zoom. I don't see anything wrong with that at all, Shauna. And it's your experience, and you get to say. All
But
right.
it's just so like if I prepare like ahead, like if I'm just alone, I can talk, but as soon as I get in that on that stage or that that platform, I don't trust myself, and I don't know how to get that like free that know what I know ahead to translate into when I'm standing there, other than to
Well,
do
like I
what I
say,
need.
take your, you don't have to use them, but you can take your notes up with you. Sometimes just knowing that they're there is enough. Right?
Okay.
You just focus on carrying the message to the addict that's suffering. I wouldn't give any concern to what people might think about you having your cheat sheet up there.
Okay.
You're
Thanks for that.
welcome.
I have a
ahead.
comment. Are you open to a comment?
Yeah, come on in, Greg.
Yeah, like you, I also take usually just one card cheat sheet, and when I'm doing a lead, and I find I've rehearsed it well enough that really I know it, but I just need the security blanket of
That's
having that card, and then I'm good. You know, if all else fails, okay, here it is. But usually that's okay. And the stuff I forget, I just figure is God editing that out. They didn't really need to hear it.
Yeah, no, that's really good intel, Greg. And I've done that myself. So, yes. I look forward to hearing you all out there in the rooms.
Thanks, Cameron.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks again,
Thank
Cameron.
You, Cameron.
It was a great workshop.
Thanks, everybody. I'm going to shut down the channel in 5, 4.
Love the
Thank
love
you,
the tuxedo.
Thanks, too.
You love and light. Thank you.
All right. Take care, everyone. Enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Bye-bye.
All right. Bye now.